issues and people she cared about. Hillary may have lost this election, but she refused to be defeated. I talked with Hillary during the campaign about how she makes it through tough times. She said she gets up every day, focuses on what she has to do that day, does the best she can on that day, and then gets up the next day and does it again. Pretty simple. Takes a lot of fortitude, though. She has plenty of that. It is an empowering and liberating lesson. I hope it is one you take to heart, Madam President. There will be many times in your career when you will be told you have been beaten. When that happens, think of the stories I am about to tell you. These people face devastating moments when life told them they lost, but they refused to be defeated. They mourned their losses, then they dug deep to figure out a way to keep going and do what they could do to make their lives matter. Elizabeth Edwards always managed to find a way to make her life matter. Elizabeth was the wife of my one-time boss and presidential candidate, Senator John Edwards. I first met her at their home when I came to interview to be John's press secretary in late 2002. We hit it off immediately and remained close friends until her death in 2010. We both grew up in Navy families, came from an Italian-American background, and shared a tendency to get pretty sassy. Elizabeth was one of the smartest people I have ever known and certainly had the quickest wit. The best way I can describe the special talents she had is to say that she lived life with enormous ambition on a small scale. She was very knowledgeable about policy and cared a great deal about the world around her. But where she placed all her ambition and where she created real magic was in the comparatively small-scale lives of her family and friends. She once actually captained an effort to grow a golf course for her son and his friends to wear as a Halloween costume. She soaked 18 boys' sweatsuits in water and grass seed, hung the suits over hangers covered in plastic dry cleaning bags to simulate a greenhouse, and grew grass suits for them all to wear. That is ambition. Elizabeth honestly believed she had all of life's answers. Other than preventing or undoing death, she thought there was a solution to any problem you encountered. Anyone who didn't understand that it was possible was frustrating and dull in her view. To be clear, Elizabeth thought that Elizabeth had the answers to all of life's problems. This was not a skill that she believed extended to everyone. But thankfully, for those of us in her life, she was there to tell us what we needed to do. Elizabeth endured a lot of heartache. Most notably, her 16-year-old son, Wade, was killed in a car accident in 1996. She said she had imagined her mind before Wade's death as a crowded chalkboard upon which she scrawled everything she worried about, cared about, and needed or wanted to do. It was completely filled, every inch of space taken up, covered in little scribbles of chalk. When Wade died, everything on the board was erased. The entire board wiped clean. She let it sit empty for a long time after that. Once your board has been wiped clean, you want to be very deliberate about what you put on it. When Elizabeth first told me about her chalkboard, I thought I understood. It made sense. Don't sweat the small stuff. Focus on the things that matter, like your children. I saw it as a call for each individual to be deliberate about the choices in his or her life in order to live the most rewarding life. I stood before my own blank slate in November 2016 and realized that I had failed to see the deeper purpose in Elizabeth's new board. It's not just that life is fleeting or you want to be deliberate in your choices because so little is within your control. It's not about making sure your life is rewarding. It's about making sure your life matters. You want whatever time you have on this earth to matter. I should have understood 15 years ago that's what she meant. People of goodwill, working together, can make a difference. That was one of her life mantras. That's the lesson that was always at the top of her chalkboard. She stood before her blank chalkboard and thought hard about what would matter to her and bring joy back into her life. She decided to have two more children, and Emma Claire and Jack brought her enormous happiness and fulfillment. She refused to live a life without joy. For her, that would have been accepting defeat. Later, she would become sick with cancer, twice, She endured an unfaithful husband in front of the world. She wanted it to be known about her that she stood in the storm, and when the wind did not blow her away, she adjusted her sails. I was with her for a lot of those difficult days of cancer and infidelity. While it is true that she adjusted her sails, I know she won't mind me telling you that she also did plenty of howling into the wind over the pain of it all. Feeling the pain is part of standing in the storm. You shouldn't try to escape it or suppress the grief the pain causes. The pain isn't what will defeat you. What matters is what you choose to do once the storm passes. On the night of Wednesday, December 1st, 2010, Elizabeth called me from her home in Chapel Hill to let me know that she had stopped treatments for her cancer. She would die soon. I asked her how long she had. She said weeks, maybe two, maybe eight. Not long. I asked her if she thought she would be with Wade after she passed. She said she did. Neither one of us had much to say after that, because it's not just the friend of the sick person who doesn't know what to say in the face of this kind of news. The person facing death also doesn't know what to say. She hadn't been through this either. Still, I felt very close to Elizabeth in that moment. I knew she didn't expect some magic words of comfort from me. My presence was enough. After some minutes of silence, she told me she had happy news, too. Her eldest daughter, Kate, had gotten engaged to her beau, Trevor, over the Thanksgiving weekend. They are two of my favorite people on the planet, and I was very happy to hear this news. But it forced me to envision the world in which Kate's wedding would happen and know that Elizabeth would not be in it. The closeness I had felt to Elizabeth just minutes before started to slip away. It seemed to me she was already fading from this world. I was scheduled to fly from Washington to Raleigh the next day to testify in front of the grand jury that was hearing a case against her husband. Elizabeth did not know this. I had not talked with her for months. I had been interviewed by the Justice Department several times over the course of the last 6 months about their investigation of John. I just couldn't bring myself to talk to her during that period. Although I now regret those months, I was not around to be her friend. I told her that I was going to be in North Carolina the next day and why. She said she was sorry I had to go through the grand jury testimony. I told her I would spend the night in Chapel Hill and come see her on Friday. I hoped when I saw her, we could plan one last trip with some of her other girlfriends to visit TJ Maxx. Elizabeth was a beautiful woman who on most days cared little about how she looked or what she wore. Nevertheless, she loved to shop. Though truth be told, she had terrible taste in clothes. If she ever drove past a TJ Maxx without stopping, it wasn't when she was in my company. Sometimes she would buy something for me after having shopped there on her own. The clothes she purchased for me can only be described as frocks. Always weird, smock-like shirts or dresses in a mismatch of patterns. Just awful. They were gifts for me, but she also wanted me to see how little she'd paid for them. "Look," she would cry, showing me the price tag. "Can you believe what a good deal I got on this?" And I would say, "Why, yes, Elizabeth. Yes, I can." Once, and only once, she purchased a very beautiful white Cynthia Raleigh cardigan sweater at a TJ Maxx in New Hampshire. She is wearing it on the paperback edition of her book, Saving Graces. It is my favorite picture of her. She made me promise that when she died, I would make sure the press used the photo of her in the Cynthia Raleigh sweater. I kept my promise. So I hoped one last TJ Maxx trip with her and maybe a stop at Sonic Drive-In, her idea of a perfect day, would be possible. But when I saw her that Friday morning, I realized it was too late. She was alert and very much herself, but already restricted to her bed. I stayed for a few hours. It felt like one of our normal visits, our conversation a mix of the everyday and the big stuff. We talked about whether she was scared. She was relieved to tell me she was not scared to die. She was at peace and knew she would soon see Wade. I was very relieved to hear that. She asked me what Jim and my stepdaughters, Liz and Kat, were up to. She fretted about how the UNC basketball team would fare against Kentucky that weekend. UNC won. We talked about redecorating my home, and she had some views on paint and furniture color combinations. I took her advice. Eventually, I asked her if she wanted to share some kind of goodbye message for all the people, mostly women, who had derived so much strength and grace from her books. I said it could be pretty distressing for some of her admirers to just learn one day that she was gone, with no final words from her to assure them that she was fine at the end, and that those also facing a terminal disease would be fine too. She agreed and asked me to take notes for her on what she wanted to say. I left to catch my flight with a promise to come back the next week to see her. I gave her a hug and walked out of her room. She called to me on my way out of her house. Love you, JP. Love you, Elizabeth. I called back. When I got to the airport, I typed up her notes and sent them in an email to her and her brother, Jay Ananiah. The next day, John Edwards called me to say the doctors thought she could die that night. Christina Reynolds, my friend who had worked on the Edwards campaigns with me and also been very close to Elizabeth, and I flew down to be there. When I landed in Raleigh, it was snowing, something that had not happened in Raleigh in many years. The night had an otherworldly quality. When we got to the house, Elizabeth was still alive but could no longer converse. I was very grateful for the time she and I had the day before. On Monday, Kate posted the goodbye message on Elizabeth's Facebook page. Elizabeth died the next day. I continued to find inspiration in this passage from her post. I have found that in the simple act of living with hope and in the daily effort to have a positive impact in the world, the days I do have are made all the more meaningful and precious. I thought of Elizabeth's message when I met the mothers of the movement during Hillary's campaign. They are African-American mothers who lost their children to gun violence and or at the hands of the police. As they say, they were turning their mourning into a movement. Geneva Reed Veal, Gwen Carr, Sabrina Fulton, Lucia McBath, these women have so much courage and grace. They are struggling to look beyond their loss, which in most cases happen because of the color of their child's skin, to seek justice and foster more understanding with the hope that other families don't suffer the same pain they have. They speak of their work in the movement as a way to continue to parent the children they lost. They have found a way to make sure their children's lives and their own lives continue to matter. These mothers may be heartbroken, but they are not defeated. I thought of Elizabeth's message when I met Mark Barden, father of Daniel Barden, who was killed in the Newtown shooting. I personally have never seen a more devastated soul on God's earth than a parent who lost a child in Newtown. Yet Mark, in his devastation, works tirelessly to do all he can to fight gun violence and continue to parent Daniel's memory. He has made sure Daniel's life and Mark's own time on this earth continue to matter. While Mark may be heartbroken, he is not defeated. And I thought of Elizabeth's message when my own sister Dana called to tell me that she had early onset Alzheimer's. It was a shocking diagnosis, but the way Dana decided she was going to handle it was not at all surprising. She told all of her family members that we were to see her diagnosis as a blessing. It would allow her to retire early. It would motivate our family to spend more time together than we otherwise would have. She may have fewer days on the earth than she wanted, but she would make sure the days she did have left mattered. She made good on her promise and spent her remaining time trying to have a positive impact on the lives of the people around her every day. As her world got smaller, Dana held tight to a mantra that defined the elements of her life. May I be safe and loved. May I be happy and healthy. May I be kind and caring. May I know that all is well. The disease took away many years of her life, but instead of focusing on what had been lost, Dana redefined her universe, stripping away all the excess and embracing a life lived solely to maximize its harmony with and benevolent influence on those around her. She was not defeated. She made me very proud to be her sister. Madam President, I hope you never know the heartache of a lost child or a devastating illness, but like all of us, you will face moments of tragedy and loss and be tested by them. When you fall short or the country gets discouraged, look beyond the loss before you to see what else is possible. you may need to set your sights farther in the future, dig a little deeper, and find the strength to keep going. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that any cause or battle you take on has to be won in order to have been worth doing. Believe that the effort you put into something that really matters to you is its own reward, whether your efforts succeed or not. If your cause is right, you will eventually prevail. Till then, stay true to your principles, will yourself to fight on. You will never be defeated. Chapter 9. Bound together. We are bound together. Now we need to unite. This story ends where it started, election night, 2016. It is a story of a national reckoning that was a long time coming. It's a cautionary tale with an important lesson about the country you are to lead. That Americans truly are bound together, even when they're not united. On this night, I see for the first time the CNN chyron, Donald Trump elected U.S. president. He is giving his victory speech. I find it odd that CNN felt the need to specify U.S. president. In that moment, I also see myself on my couch in Alexandria, Virginia on November 7th, 2000, CNN chyron, George Bush elected president. Myself in our Columbus boiler room of the Ohio Kerry campaign headquarters on November 3rd, 2004. CNN chyron, George Bush re-elected president. Myself at the BBC studio in Washington, D.C. on November 4th, 2008. CNN chyron, Barack Obama elected president. Myself in the Roosevelt room of the White House on November 6th, 2012. CNN chyron, Barack Obama, re-elected president. Madam President, in that instant, I tried to fathom how each of those nights had been leading us to this one. I tried to fathom the frustrations that had been building, the fissures solidifying into divisions and taking hold in America. I could not process it all in that moment, but this much was clear to me. America would have to endure a reckoning. I had hoped that the election itself would be this reckoning. It was clear by the fall of 2015 that this election cycle was something different. It wasn't going to be simply a change election or a referendum on Obama or even an election about the economy. It was about what kind of country we were going to be. You could feel that all these frustrations that had been simmering underground for a long time had roiled to the surface. My hope was that the campaign would be the vessel through which America would face this reckoning, select Hillary over Trump, progress over regression, love over hate, and we would move on reassured that America had some of its core principles tested and chose the right path. By 3 a.m. on Wednesday, it was becoming clearer the election was not going to be the end of this battle. It was just the beginning. There were moments along the way that hinted that this reckoning was coming. Like Friday, June 26th, 2015. It had been a remarkable couple of days. On Thursday, the United States Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act. On Friday, it ruled on the right of gay people to marry in this country. In the wake of the terrible race-motivated shootings at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, it looked like the Confederate flag might finally be removed from the grounds of the South Carolina State House. And on Friday afternoon, after speaking emotionally about the gay marriage decision in the Rose Garden that morning, President Obama broke out into an impromptu rendition of Amazing Grace at the Charleston Memorial Service for the 9 people killed in that shooting. That Friday night, I took a walk around my Fort Greene neighborhood. I couldn't stop smiling. It wasn't just me. All of Brooklyn was in a good mood, celebrating the payoff of decades upon decades of struggle that had gone into making the progress represented in that one week. I took time to think through all the years of effort it had taken to make these wins possible. The healthcare fight started at the time of FDR, LGBTQ rights before that, and we had fought a war more than 150 years ago about that flag. Even as I sat among the happy Brooklynites celebrating love being love, I knew there were people in America who wouldn't welcome any of this. Upholding Obamacare, gay marriage, the loss of the display of the Confederate flag, is progress. Rather, they would look upon this week and feel alienated in their own country. That's a sad and terrible way to have to live. I thought of Donald Trump, who had announced his candidacy for president 2 weeks prior with a divisive speech that painted a picture of America in decline. The frustration felt in America was not limited to these three areas. It was growing everywhere. Boy, I thought, we could be in for one hell of a backlash. That first summer of the campaign, we had our hands full with our own primary, but watched what was happening with the rise of Trump on the Republican side with an equal mix of schadenfreude and unease, as the Republican Party seemed intent on nominating the most polarizing candidate imaginable. We saw that Trump was striking a chord with voters in a way you rarely see in campaigns and breaking all the rules of politics as he did it. By the fall of 2015, Hillary and Bill Clinton understood there was a deep and disturbing disaffection at work in the electorate. Initially, I thought, or at least hoped, they were wrong. They aired these concerns in earnest at one of our first debate prep sessions in the fall of 2015. We were working in a ballroom of the Doral Arrowwood. Both the Clintons were there and sharing how disconcerted they felt by what they saw from voters on the campaign trail, both on the Democratic side and in the Republican primary. Anger, alienation, a dearth of hope. It troubled them greatly. They had never seen anything like it. It was pretty sobering to be told by these two that they were experiencing something in politics that even they had not experienced. I told them I thought they were misreading the trajectory voters were on. I believed that 2010 had been the year of true voter disaffection. Because Hillary was Secretary of State at that time and therefore not involved in the midterm elections, the Clintons hadn't experienced them the way they were experiencing this election. That was the year of anger, I said. 2012 was better. 2016 was 7 years on from the recession, so voter dissatisfaction would be further eased. No, they were right. 2016 was something different. Another debate prep, February 2016. A different room at the same Doral Arrowwood. The same players. We had lost New Hampshire the night before by 22 points. It was one of the worst days of the campaign. This time, I just listened when the Clintons aired their fears. I knew they were right. They had both reread The True Believer by Eric Hoffer and told us all we should read it. Hoffer wrote it in the 1950s about the rise of mass movements and authoritarian leaders. The Clintons feared there were parallels between the story laid out in the book and what we were living through in America in 2016. Hoffer postulates that people's frustration doesn't come out during a crisis, like a war or times of extreme poverty. During those times, people are focused on surviving. They have purpose and don't have the luxury or inclination to rebel. Frustration comes later, when circumstances in a country are improving, but not fast enough, or not for everyone, or when people are angered and unsettled by the lack of purpose they feel now, compared to the worth they felt their lives had when they were part of a larger struggle during the time of crisis. It is at this time that they gravitate towards dangerous leaders, those who lead by pitting people against each other, who have no coherent agenda, but attract people by offering them a sense of reflected glory, who sound and act just like Donald Trump. I read the book. It was filled with stories of the kind of things you think can't happen in America. But the Clintons were right. I saw a lot of parallels to what we were experiencing in America in 2016. After all, our country had been through very trying times. We had faced enormous change, stress, and disruption in the last 15 years. I used to think about it when I worked in the Obama White House. I knew we would look back at the first part of the 21st century as a time of enormous upheaval. September 11th, two wars, the Great Recession, enormous demographic changes, ever-growing economic inequality, a dramatic tech revolution, the digital economy, climate change. What about me? What part of this do I own, Madam President? Some friends kindly said to me after the election that they hoped I didn't blame myself for the loss. The first few times I heard this, I was a little taken aback. Blame myself? Don't worry. I didn't. I knew I did everything I could. I left it all on the field. Still, I was part of a political class that thought we alone understood the rules of politics and everyone had to play by those rules as established by us. After a while, the public is ready to believe that politics really is just a game, that none of it really matters. They think their democracy doesn't have anything to do with them. It's a game set up and managed by a handful of people in Washington. Anyway, I guess the joke's on me. Donald Trump violated just about every rule there was in politics and won. He defied gravity. Disruption had come to my industry the way it had to so many others. Nothing made sense to me anymore. Right. This is how the man who worked in coal his whole life and now can't find a decent job feels. This is how the cab driver who has been run out of business by Uber feels. This is how everyone feels whose life plan was blown up by some unexpected and confounding force. I've accepted that the days of being able to predict how our politics will play out are over. I have also accepted that's how it should be. A small number of people in Washington shouldn't be able to predict, let alone orchestrate, what our entire democracy is going to do. That paradigm had to topple. It needed to topple. It's why I shake my head when my friends in politics talk about how the political parties in Washington have to figure out what their national message is, as if things are going to go back to normal after the 2016 elections, as if Washington types can still control outcomes, as if that world hasn't already blown up. That's not how this is going down. The rebirth will come from the ground up, or it won't come at all. During the course of the campaign, I had the chance to go to most states in America. The upheaval was happening everywhere, across every demographic. We were overdue for a reckoning of grievances, and we lived in a new world where people have more platforms and means than ever to express those grievances. Madam President, it is important for you to know that I have never thought this reckoning necessarily spells doom for America. It could, if we don't figure out a way to bridge our differences, but I am hopeful because I see a unifying thread linking these groups of frustrated Americans. They all thought America could be better than it was in that moment, that America wasn't living up to her values. The world was changing fast, both economically and socially, and it seemed like America wasn't able to adjust, as it always has in the past. To many on both sides of the ideological spectrum, it felt like our political leadership was only making the divisions in our country worse. The two sides were certainly very far apart, but the bottom line is that everyone expected better of this country. To me, that is common ground upon which to build. And because of that, I find this reckoning reassuring to some degree. It shows that we really are all in this together. The pain one group feels in America can't stay isolated forever. Eventually, it will spill out and we will all feel it because we are connected to each other. The charge now is to move from understanding that we are bound together to choosing to be united, to live up to our best values so everyone feels like they are part of this country and can see the path for how they can succeed here, to build enough understanding among all of us that a gain for one isn't seen as a loss by another. What's the lesson for you to make sure we don't allow this kind of disaffection and corrosive alienation to take hold again? Be a president for all of America, the people who vote for you and the ones who don't. Listen to everyone's concerns, and even when you can't agree with people, make sure they know you have heard them, that you understand their point of view, and that there is a place for everyone at the table. Sounds like a good job for a woman. And a good place for my letter to end. The lessons I shared are hard-earned, and the advice I offer is well-meaning. I hope they boost your confidence and make you appreciate the breadth of talents you will bring to this job. Frankly, I have been surprised to find myself in a position to advise you and other women on how we can reach equality with men. I spent most of my life thinking we were already there. We are not. For me, it took living through Hillary's bewildering campaign and processing the factors behind her loss to understand that we are not there. For other women, it was the promotion that never came, or the umpteenth time a male colleague was lauded for an idea that had been ignored when a woman suggested it earlier, or the most recent time you were told you were a good sport for staying later than all the men and being the one who did all the real work that showed us we are not there. Some women I know, particularly women who are black or brown, less wealthy, or older than I am, have always understood that we have not reached equality. I am just one woman. I can only offer lessons culled from my own experiences, and I know I have lived a life of privilege that made being fearless in the workplace an easier and a relatively risk-free thing for me to do. Still, I ask you and all the women listening to this to embrace the lessons I have told you here, look at the work before us, and be inspired, not discouraged. A better world than we have ever known is in the offing, a world where women are able to achieve all we seek to achieve, and everyone is better off for it. It's exciting. So when disaster strikes and the unimaginable happens, don't allow yourself to be defeated. Look around the new world you are in and imagine what else may be possible for you there. Speak up. Cry if you are moved to do so. Don't stifle your emotions or your ambitions. Don't wait for permission or an invitation or expect to find your place in someone else's story. Jump in to whatever it is you want to do. Embrace your age and all that your experience gives you to teach the rest of us. Try seeing your male colleagues as partners, not masters. And if men refuse to see you as an equal, and you aren't able to lead them, beat them, or join them, then just ignore them. Don't let anyone, man or woman, decide if you matter. You know you do. You already hold all the wisdom, strength, and confidence you need to accomplish whatever it is you want to do. What has held us back before is merely our collective inability to imagine what is possible for us to do. The talent and wisdom have always been there. The generations of women before us stormed the shores and secured a beachhead for us, but it's up to us, the women in America today, to finish the job. It's a thrilling challenge. Go show us what a woman leading in this new world looks like. We can't wait to see. With love and admiration, Jennifer.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Dear Madam President, an open letter to the women who will run the world. Written and read by Jennifer Palmieri. Produced and directed by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Isabella Ness. Post-production by Beat Street NYC. Dear Madam President is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Jennifer Palmieri. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.